Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arscast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. I'm sitting here this morning with a cup of coffee out of my Marc Maron WTF podcast cat mug. And it's the morning after a 1-0 win over Karabag in the Europa League. Normally on a podcast like this, we would spend some time talking about the game, talking about the performance, but it was such a, I'm not going to say irrelevant, because it wasn't irrelevant. There were some moments and some things in that game which were important. But overall, it's not one of those games that really needs or merits a huge amount of analysis on a podcast. We'd already won the group in the Europa League. We knew we were going to top the group and qualify for the knockout stages. So it was about the small stories, the little stories, the things that make up the fabric of a football club and a football team. And there were a few of those last night, not least of which was the return to action for Lauren Koscielny after 6 months out. You remember that he suffered that terrible Achilles injury in the Europa League semi-final against Atletico Madrid back in May. And I remember at the time, I remember thinking, as I saw him on the ground, that Diego Costa had done something to him off the ball. Costa, being the big evil brute that he is, must have smashed him in the head, and we were looking the other way. It turns out that the injury was so bad, Costa was actually concerned for another human being. That's how bad this injury was. He'd been playing for a long time with a chronic Achilles issue, and unfortunately that night it all went wrong. His Achilles tendon ruptured, and here we are, 6 months down the line, and he stepped out on the pitch for the first time, and you could see from the time he lined up in the tunnel ahead of the game how much it meant to him. You know, you think when a player gets to 33, they've kind of been there, done that, seen it all, but just the sheer happiness on his face was brilliant. In the tunnel, during the game, after the game, when he was taken off, he just looked so happy to be out on the pitch again. And of course, it's very timely because we do have something of a central defensive crisis going into the game on Sunday against Southampton. No Mustafi, no Socrates, no Rob Holding, of course, who's out for the rest of the season. So to see Koscielny back and to come through the game seemingly with no ill effects, we have to wait and see, but he didn't look like he was feeling anything or feeling any pain. So that's a really positive part of that game. And also the performances from some of our young players. Ainsley Maitland-Niles back in the team, did well at left back and was moved further forward when we made some changes in the second half and played really well on the right hand side of the front three. So that was good to see. Joe Willock, Eddie Nketiah getting a run out, and of course there was an exciting home debut for 17-year-old Bukayo Saka, who is thought very, very highly of at academy level. He really is an exciting prospect, and we saw flashes of that, didn't we, in the game against Karabag. He had some lovely skills, worked really hard, and late on had a chance to score a goal, which the keeper saved with his face, unfortunately. Just a little bit more composure in a situation like that, but you can't blame a 17-year-old for snatching at it a little bit, you know, given the occasion and the opportunity, and he probably had his name in lights before he'd taken the shot. So there's probably a lesson to be learned there for him, but a really exciting debut. Unai Emery, very, very happy with him, saying that he played with big personality and he's got qualities that can help the team. Whether that means we're going to see more of him in the weeks and months ahead, it remains to be seen. But there is definitely a gap in this squad right now for a player who can give us something from the bench. And I know it's a lot to put on his young shoulders, and maybe we're getting carried away with ourselves, but it is what we do, isn't it? When we see a young player at Arsenal come in and play well, we immediately think, this guy's the best player I've ever seen. unquestionably. So we'll wait and see. But a very promising debut and a very encouraging debut for another Academy graduate who looks like they could make the grade. It's a very interesting time at the Arsenal Academy. There are some very, very good young players coming through. Unai Emery seems like the kind of manager who's prepared to give young players a chance too. I know it's easier in the Carabao Cup and it's easier in the Europa League, particularly when you're playing a kind of a dead rubber game. But, you know, this is a guy who threw in 19-year-old Matteo Guendouzi for the first few games of the season. He came from League Two and he played against Chelsea, he played against Manchester City. So if he sees the quality of the talent is there, he's not afraid to give them a chance. And I think some of these young players will be knocking on the door of the first team. And that's a positive thing as well, because there are spaces and there are places up for grabs in this squad still as Emery shapes it and molds it the way he wants. So we'll wait and see how that all goes in the weeks ahead. What else? Mesut Ozil is back. That was good. He's been out for about a month, so with the festive schedule coming up, it will be good for him to be back and fit and ready and get some minutes under his belt. He got an assist of sorts. It was one of those assists where he played the final pass, but Lacazette still had something to do. Lacazette in the team, we assume, for fitness reasons. He's been in and out with a groin problem, so maybe they're just trying to get him back up to speed, because there are difficult games coming up between now and the end of the year and maybe early in January as well. So it was good to see him back. That was his eighth goal of the season. Beyond that, there isn't a great deal to say about the Carabao game. The Europa League group stage is over. The draw for the knockout rounds will take place on Monday, and we'll find out who we've got then. That is something to look forward to. Those games kick off again, I think, in February. The knockout stages of the Europa League. But for now, we can put Europe on the back burner and concentrate more or less on the Premier League. There is a Carabao Cup quarterfinal against Tottenham next week, and the FA Cup starts in January as well. So January could also be hectic if we do come through that game against Tottenham on Wednesday. I presume it's Wednesday night. Should have looked this up, shouldn't I? I'll just do some very quick Googling here and double check that. Yes, it is Wednesday at 7:45. If we come through that game, a two-legged semi-final at some point in January as well. So that will stretch the squad, but also allow Unai Emery to rotate and maybe give more chances to young players. Right. Coming up a bit later on, I am going to be talking to Josh James, who I'm sure many of you will know as somebody who writes things for Arsenal.com, but he is the co-author of a brand new book called Arsenal, The Complete Record, a fantastic compendium, a tome of stats and information, and basically every game that Arsenal have ever played is in this book, with the lineups, with the players, with the goal scorers, loads of stats about managers, attendances, our record against other teams. It's a brilliant book. So I'm going to be talking to Josh about that a bit later on. I'll also give you the winner of the t-shirt competition from last week, with thanks to goodhonestpro.com. So stand by for that. But first, a more serious discussion. A number of people were in touch with me this week wondering why we didn't touch on the Raheem Sterling incident in the Arscast Extra on Monday. And my feeling was basically that it would be somewhat reductive for two white men to sit and talk about racism directed at a black player, about racism in football. We all know what happened. A Chelsea fan leaned over the advertising hoardings and screamed aggressively at Raheem Sterling, calling him a fucking black cunt, which, lest we forget, is exactly what John Terry called Anton Ferdinand a few years back, and he received a trifling ban and fine for that. So that's indicative of the challenges that football faces in dealing with these kind of things, and maybe the example that sets and how it resonates throughout the game and beyond. But anyway, I thought it would be better to speak to two people who are far more knowledgeable and better informed about this than I could ever be, which isn't to say I don't understand that racism is bad. Of course, everybody listening to this, I'm sure, understands that on that very basic level, racism is bad. There's no condoning it in any single way, regardless of what anyone puts on their Instagram or how they dress or anything like that. But it requires, I think, the right perspective and the right people to talk about it. And I think I've got those people here today. First up, a pleasure as always to welcome back Tayo Papula. Hi, Tayo.
Hey, Andrew. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. And from the Arsenal Vision podcast, Clive Palmer. Hi, Clive.
Hey, mate. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Clive, can I start with you and just ask you, not your reaction to the abuse that was leveled at Raheem Sterling, because I'm sure that won't have been a surprise to you. Maybe the how blatant it was in a football ground might just be a little bit of a surprise, but we'll come back to that later on. But the statement from Raheem Sterling, which appears to have, if you'll excuse the expression, blown the whole thing wide open, because it sparked so much more coverage from a different angle than just angry racist guy being racist.
Yeah, I think we've all been through these race storms, different ones. You mentioned John Terry, the Luis Suarez. There's been a few of them, and they come along. They normally come along in international breaks when we've got time to discuss them, right? And then they disappear as soon as the next game comes up. When the next big game comes up, we stop talking about it. But what Sterling did really beautifully was he called people out in a subtle way. He made people look at how they message, how they write things. And he made people think, actually, how are we influencing how black people are perceived? And that story, the two stories alongside each other, brought that into stark reality. And the way it was done, it wasn't done about himself. He used examples of other people, two young people just making their way in the game, and how we write about them differently. And that gave no one any wiggle room to hide, and we had to look at ourselves collectively. And I, for one, I've been pleasantly surprised by the intelligence, the depth of thought. In all of the reaction that I've read, maybe some of the things I don't want to read, I've moved past, but all the reaction that I've read, I think has been really different this time compared to the previous convenient fill spaces in newspapers and podcasts and type reactions that we've seen before. So I've been, quietly surprised and positive, really.
Tayo, from your point of view, has the reaction been the same? Because we saw, I guess, a bit of introspection on behalf of certain people in the media. I was thinking of Gary Neville, the way he spoke on Sky Sports, having, basically admitting, I knew there was abuse, but, it's something you kind of push to the back of your mind. There have been other people. Daniel Taylor wrote a really good piece in The Guardian as well about working in the newspaper industry, in the, working as a tabloid journalist, and how that industry needs to address the way that it writes about certain people or certain ethnic groups or whatever it might be. Does it feel different to you this time?
I think what Clive said there was brilliantly put. I would say it doesn't feel... I wouldn't say it feels different this time. I mean, as a black football fan, as a black man, then there's so much... there's something that Raheem Sterling said in this statement, which again, enjoyed is the wrong word, but bear with me, is that where he says that, he heard it, and he almost didn't want to focus on it. It's almost like that was par for the course.
Yeah.
And that was, it was almost like that was the bit that was, that he could brush off his shoulder a lot easier, because, I don't often engage in these kind of conversations out loud, because I've got my own views and my own ways of dealing with things and my own experiences that I don't always feel I'm going to benefit anyone else, let alone myself, from talking about too much. But obviously this is a bit different. So with that in mind, I wouldn't say it feels different this time. I've seen, that you mentioned a load of journalists there before. I think Daniel Harris is someone as well, who's written on Raheem Sterling before. People like Football 365 have always done it in their kind of media watch and so on. So it's been around before. And it's so obvious, it's so clear to, to black men who deal with this, or black women who deal with this, I should say, black people who deal with this on a regular, that when I say, I'm not surprised, Andrew, I'm heartened by, you mentioned Gary, I thought Gary Neville's kind of introspection was great. I think he was looking at himself and saying, I'm asking myself, should I have said or done something earlier? I thought he articulated himself really well. as ever, I think Gary Lineker has kind of made himself, proved himself to be the most likable player who ever played for them, and brought the debate, used his kind of platform to keep the debate live. And I do agree that we are going to, we have to be careful about moving on. It's easy for people to move on from this. And it's also, it's not so easy for people who have to live with this all the time and who this becomes par for the course. Mm. And Clive talked about the language there, and it's so true. It's like, unless you stop and, unless you stop, check yourself. And we're talking about a race issue here, but we've also had a year of, you know, kind of Me Too conversations where people, maybe there's something to be examined here. And I really do think that if somebody says something's wrong, don't turn around and tell them that they're wrong to feel like that. Yeah. So in that sense, I'm glad that this conversation is coming up. Will much change? No. And that's why, and again, Clive, you said the stuff that you've read, and we all know what the kind of fat-headed elephant in the room is as well. you know, and the only reason why I want to kind of mention him in abstract terms is because it's the danger of somebody with such a platform, yeah, so spectacularly missing the point, but not missing the point, because, you know, everyone's been talking about calling people out. I'm not shy here. Because Piers Morgan's not missing the point. He's deliberately, you know, he's straw-manning it to the nth degree. And I only mention that because it's dangerous. The danger here, the thing that's kind of most disappointing here, is because the kind of people who is that kind of reasoned, it seems like a reasonable argument, but it's more pernicious by ignoring the point, by talking over, you know, the likes of Clark Carlisle and Darren Lewis on the clips that I've seen of that show. It's that danger. It's putting forward in this kind of bombastic way, this alternative point of view, which is refusing to see the point, which is the kind of, which then becomes the, you know, it becomes the kind of get out for, you know, people who wear small glasses and use the cry laugh emoji and have got, you know, crusaders in their avatars. It gets used by those people, yeah, in the wrong way. And that's what I'm most disappointed about here. I thought Raheem Sterling nailed it with his statement. I love that. I love the way he did it. I love the way he brushed his shoulder off. I'm a little bit disappointed with some of the reaction, as I just mentioned, and that's what kind of stays with me more than ever. If it gets people talking about it like we're doing it now, then that's great.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing, you know, to have a discussion about this. It's not part of my reality, whereas it's something that you guys have had to deal with your entire lives. And that's why I think you made a great point, Tayo, that it is important when somebody says something to you, you need to listen. I mean, you even think about this furore, whether it's a thing or not, about the fairy tale of New York and this discussion over the word faggot in the song, and people are saying, well, it's just a word, it's part of a character. But if enough gay people are telling you that this is problematic, it behooves us to listen to them in the same way that what Raheem Sterling said. I just going back to Sterling and just sort of the way that certain things were reported, you mentioned Football 365, and they've done fantastic stuff on Media Watch to call out the kind of reporting that's been done around him. But there's an amazing example here from Sky Sports, where after he got the tattoo of the gun, which again was something that Piers Morgan reacted to in the way that you described, Tayo. And he said in his statement, he said, after I saw my father killed, or after my father was killed when I was two, he didn't see it. He said, I made a promise to myself I would never touch a gun in my life. On Sky Sports News, Clive, they reported that, and it said, I made a promise to myself that I would never touch a gun again in my life. Subconsciously, deliberately, whatever it is, it completely and utterly changes the context of that. And it's impossible to look at it outside the prism of the color of his skin.
Yeah, it's subtle conditioning, right?
Yeah.
And this is something that, you know, most black people have had to live within the environment that's given to them. And this is what is unique about this situation. Raheem Sterling is a uniquely talented individual. He's the highest paid British footballer in the country. If you ever see a video of him when he was 14 playing for QPR, under four, as a, in an under 18 game, as a 14-year-old, when he was about 2'3", running running through them like a knife through butter. This is a talent that was coming for many, many years. Liam Brady, I don't know how you missed him, right? But that's another subject, another subject, right? So, so he is unique. He is special. He has circumnavigated a lot of what's been thrown at him, and he's managed to make it to a point where he's a Premiership winner, England's number 10, and he's only just starting where he's going to end up. But this all affects people just like me and Tyo, really. And one of the things that I do is I mentor some young athletes, and I help them try to get jobs and interviews and things like that. And what's really stark for me, these are highly qualified people, and how hard it is for them to get the break that they need. And the people that I worry about who read all these preconceptions and have all these messages are the ones that are providing opportunities for young black people to better themselves. And if you can't better yourself, that dictates your whole life. So this Raheem Sterling, he will be fine. He will have hard times, but he will be fine. We'll have the support around him. But these young guys fresh out of university that are going into these city institutions, for example, to try to get a role, they're not getting that chance. They're not maybe getting a fair chance. And if they do get a chance and they fail, their second chance opportunity isn't there. That means the standards by which you are judged are completely different. Now, that's what an average black person lives with every single day. That's what I live with every single day. And it doesn't mean I want anyone to cry for me. That's the way I've been brought up. That's the country that I live in. Now, when we start to change the perception of people like myself, and I'm very, very lucky, by the way, I've got no problems with work or earnings or family or anything like that. I'm very lucky, the people around me, but not everybody is. And it's those people that I would like to see get a greater opportunity in life. And if by Raheem Sterling bringing this out, I'm hoping the debate will reach, don't worry about Raheem, he'll be fine. Don't worry about LeBron James, he'll be fine. Worry about the average guy, the young kids that are trying to be the part of the next generation, trying to integrate into the British society, are not being allowed to fully, so they feel completely disenfranchised from what's happening around them. And there are enclaves within this country where that is real. It is real. It really is real. And so this debate, I mean, what you're saying there, Tyler, I hear you about some of the idiots in the room, but I actually tried not to listen to them because I've heard that before.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? I tried to seek out different people. I don't know if you've heard Jonathan Liu on the Independent podcast. You've got to try to listen to it. It is outstanding how he's responded about the savior complex of certain people in the media coming out and saying, jump into the front of this cavalry. When previously they've had opportunities to protect black players and they haven't taken them. So now, is it fashionable? Is it topical? Was it because it was a Sky game live on TV? Mm. We don't know, but we're talking about it now. And that, to me, is a huge positive. So I prefer to focus on those individual bits of positives to see how people are bringing different positive messages into the discussion point rather than the idiots that we've known and with their 6 million followers that we all know exactly what they think. They're not teaching us anything.
This is part of my point, Clive, though, because I don't follow. I've got, you know, it appears on my timeline whenever it does.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Conversation with you, and then the conversation, and you know, you talked about it being a thing in international breaks to move on for somebody like Piers Morgan, for example. Another reason why it's so pernicious is because, you know, 2 days later it'll be going on about Little Mix again or something. You know what I mean? It's like it's a role for a contrarian to take a point of view when there's people's lives who are dealing with it, and not people like you mentioned, like Raheem Sterling will be fine. I mean, I just made a program about this, talking to various black footballers up and down the country, and John Barnes, and he made his point very eloquently on BBC. John Barnes is a big advocate of this. He said this in my program. He was like, well, don't worry about John Barnes, you know, worry about, and Brendan Batson said the same, my brother's a mechanic, worry about him and his mates. Do you know what I mean? Because it's there every day, and we're talking about, we're talking about people in the media or people like yourself or like myself who, you know, are kind of, you know, all right, thanks. You know what I mean? But, you know, I grew up with the same stuff. around and navigated my way through it. But as many people who don't. So that noise that's around it is dangerous because it hardens the views of people, of certain people, because it comes from, it hardens the view of the average man,
yeah,
or average woman. And that kind of pernicious, bombastic, deliberately missing the point for whatever reason, whether it's for ratings or followers or anything in between, is distracting, I think, from the conversation that Raheem Sterling on this occasion tried to start, or that Paul Mortimer, John Barnes, Paul Cannaville, or anyone else has tried to start. We're talking about football, so we might as well stay talking using football references. This point is not, this hasn't happened for the first time. I remember when I spoke to John Barnes about, after I was finished fawning.
another one we missed, by the way. Let's not go on about it.
After I finished fawning, just watching, indifference is the wrong word, but like when you're so used to this kind of shit every day, or every month, then it's hard to raise up and stay angry all the time, because it will just ruin your week. Exactly. And ruin your life, so I'm very, very grateful that high profile people have turned the, like you said, Clive, who've turned a light on themselves and asked the question. It's a shame, but it's always the way that you do need, and we're talking about race here, for a race thing, the conversation needs to be picked up by white people for it not to be put into the box of dun, 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 Clive's already smiling, chip on a shoulder. You know what I mean? Mm. Right? Because we heard that one before. If somebody else raises, if a prominent black person says something, a lot of the time it can get dismissed as, playing the, I've actually ordered for Christmas, actually. I've actually ordered a couple of playing cards with the race card on the back. So next time someone says something to me, then they're getting served with one of those. What the fuck is the race card? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
The feminine card, the feminism card, or whatever card you want to play. This isn't a card. This is somebody trying to say that life has been going on like this, fine. But just because life has been going on with these conversations and these types of points of view, doesn't mean they're fucking right.
I think this is where Raheem's been really good, right? Because he's been brave enough to bring this to our attention. Now, he can afford to say, well, actually, I don't need to fit in with anybody, because you have to fit in with me because I'm super talented. The average person on the street will have to think twice about his reaction to think about like things like this, because sometimes he has to conform to the things around him and to the people around him to make sure he can do the right things by himself and or his family. And I think that's that sort of invisible pressure that people have to live with is something that really doesn't get spoken about very much, right? So, and I think that's not really saying I'm a victim. That's just saying these are the circumstances by which I live. These are the circumstances by which I have to try to progress. And I'm really keen to see those decision makers, those people that control jobs, universities, that control opportunities, they're the ones I'm hoping are looking at themselves today and thinking, okay, I've got diversity courses going on at work, but am I really, really invested? Am I really, really invested? And I hope that they're the people, I hope the messaging is actually getting through to, because the more, the greater the average man perception is improved, the better it will be for everybody. And I think it is changing, it is progressing, but the more this is spoken about, I feel the better.
We're talking, sorry to cut across you, Tayo, I just want to play something, and I'm sure you guys have both seen this, and this is from John Barnes speaking to the BBC, I think it was BBC Breakfast this week, and we're talking about things in a football context, but this is what he had to say.
Before we are members of any football fraternity, we're members of society, so we're doing it the wrong way around. You can't look at football, because for football, for 90 minutes on a Saturday, or obviously football is played at different times now, you can't just say because for the 90 minutes we don't see it anymore means it doesn't exist in society. It is prevalent in society as you go into the inner cities and see how disenfranchised and how lack of opportunities are there for members of ethnic minorities. So why should football be any different?
I was literally about to mention John Barnes. I was going to mention his Guardian article on the same thing. And I mentioned it again, as I said, I met him recently and people like him recently, black footballers, I mean. And you're right, Clive, it has got better. Of course it's got better, because it's now because it's now a taboo thing to do that. It's got better because we're having a discussion about how shocking it was to catch somebody live on TV. This happened all the time. This happened all the time in the 80s and in the late 70s and perhaps later than that, I don't know. and it wasn't. And the point is, it wasn't headline news. When John Barnes backheeled that banana in the Merseyside Derby, it was a big story. You mentioned Sky and so on now, Andrew. It was a big story because it happened in the Merseyside Derby and the best player in the country, arguably at the time, had done it.
Yeah.
And Barnes himself says, it didn't. He says he doesn't remember doing it. And he says, but, you know, I had bananas chucked at me when I played for Watford 8 years earlier, 6 years earlier, sorry. So why, you know, it becomes a headline thing because we move towards it being a taboo thing. And that's great that that happened. Yeah. But, you know, we're talking about players having to confront or conform. Do you fit in because you don't have a structure around you when you have to take this stuff and use it as banter, quote unquote, banter? Or do you stand up for yourself? There are footballers before like Bob Hazel and George Berry who confronted, you know, our very own superstar and hero, Ian Wright, says, I know he says, you know, he wasn't brought up in football where he was just supposed to grow up and accept it. He says, I think in one program, he says, I was still fighting people in play. I was still fighting people in the car park if they called me that kind of thing. Why am I going to take it when I go on the pitch? So that's an attitude. That's an attitude shift. And that's because society has shifted and because players kind of shifted. But we see that it still happens. The other thing John Barnes says in his article is that just because there isn't racist stuff being shouted in the stands, it doesn't mean there aren't any racists in the stands. They just know that they have to keep that to themselves now.
Should we, Clive, then be worried that in recent weeks, we've seen a banana skin thrown at Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang by a Tottenham fan who claims he wasn't racist. He just happened to throw a banana skin at a black footballer. And we've got this guy at Chelsea who feels emboldened to lean over, knowing more than likely that there is a camera on him because of, well, there's a camera on everything these days. And he feels emboldened enough in this day and age, in 2018, to scream fucking black cunt at Raheem Sterling and think that perhaps there won't be any consequences or repercussions for this. I think that is worrying. I know things have got better, and I know there's amazing work being done, you know, by Kick It Out, by Rainbow Laces, all these things which promote the kind of inclusivity and diversity which should be standard in football and everywhere in society. We know it's not, and that's why these things exist, and that's why they're so important. But to see that creeping back in, I think it's a worry.
It is a worry, and I've been going football since 1977. Right? And so let me tell you something. The only thing black in the stadium then was the referee's shirt, right? Apart from myself. Now, and so, and then when black players first came into the game in mass, it was very difficult. And people talk about the players. Well, trust me, the few black fans that are in that crowd, it was really tough. Really tough. It was really embarrassing. And it was really threatening. And Arsenal was one of the very few places where you could go where that did not occur in my experiences. And hence why I'm an Arsenal fan to this day, because it's always been an inclusive club. I don't see that those days coming back again, because I just don't think people would accept it. And plus, there are many different people within the ground now. I mean, when I first started going football, there was never any Asian people in the ground now. And you go to Arsenal today and there's so many people from different backgrounds. So I don't see that coming back. But I think this is linked to what's happening in world politics, I'm afraid. Mm. World politics is very divisive. What's happening in the US, what's happening in the UK, what's people looking to go back to the good old days. Right, what are the good old days? The good old days when they went to Sainsbury's and when they spoke to somebody, he would come back to them in English. That's what it means for a lot of people. And a lot of areas today, that's not the case. Right, so people are voting against that. They're voting against that and they want to be divided. So now we're voting for things that we don't want in our lives rather than think about how we can progress in our lives. And so this is all a byproduct of the divisive politics, the divisive rhetoric that's been thrown at people over the last couple of years, particularly in the world. And now people are feeling more emboldened to do these things. I don't link it to football per se. Football is just a byproduct of how people are feeling walking around every single day. And this is a place where it manifests. Now, football has an opportunity, being the global soap opera that it is, to say, well, actually, within football, we can create a new set of values where this is not acceptable. Not just saying to people, you can't do this and this is the punishment, but actually trying to get a different value system amongst supporters. Because whether that supporter said black or mank, it doesn't really matter. What really I found distasteful was the hatred on his face. The hatred on his face for that individual, regardless of what he said. And I'm not sure football actually needs that level of hatred. I mean, I am not a Tottenham fan, but you will not see me with that face at any Tottenham player. I'll tell you that for nothing. And there's no need. I'd much rather focus on my own team. I think there's an opportunity for football to look at itself and set an example, because this truly is a game that has a massive platform. And then outside of that, then just take a deep breath and say, well, actually, what is happening here? And then just look at the BBC News tonight, what's actually happening. And just look at all the Trump stuff coming through on your Twitter feed. What's happening is what's happening. We know what's happening. So we are becoming more divided as a society. So why wouldn't it manifest itself in football?
Mm.
It'll be a surprise if it didn't.
It's another mark in the sand, I think, is the most positive thing for me in terms of, you know, when Mark Walters had bananas thrown at him when he was in
Rangers.
When he was playing for Rangers.
And I was there, Tyo.
Were you on the ground?
Rangers is my second team, and I was there with Rangers. I was there when Rangers played Bruges, and Daniel Amakachi got things thrown at him, and I was in the Rangers end. So I have done a lot of travelling around Europe and watching different teams, and trust me, I know exactly what happened to Mark Walters in that stadium.
Right. Well, that, you know, in my research recently, you know, that was headline news on BBC Breakfast. Now, and it was around, and then they got John Barnes in to talk about it because it had happened to John Barnes the season before. So I guess what I mean is that if you need these kind of stakes, these milestones, as it were, where we need to talk about this in maybe years to come. If an attitude can change, if people can think about the imagery and the language, let's go back to that in the newspapers, because that form, you mentioned what goes on in the world, that kind of attitude does get formed in the papers. It's too easy to have your quote-unquote bling-bling footballer kind of image. That's very, you know, that's layer upon layer. And it becomes a problem. And I mean, again, you've got two black guys on, so we're having that conversation. But recently, you know, there's been a rise again in some of the abuse that Brighton fans that gets hurled at Brighton because of their quote, you know, because there's got the so-called links with homosexuality. You know, every single year you have the rainbow laces furore kind of thing. And so if football can do anything, I don't know too much about whether football can be this change for good. I don't know how cynical I am about it. Maybe I'm too cynical about that. But by having these kind of things by repetition, then these attitudes do change slowly. You know, we, as you said, Clive, you've grown up an Arsenal fan because Arsenal fans have always been quite inclusive. You know, I grew up in Southwest London. And by the way, I'm not making this into a Chelsea thing or a Spurs thing or a Millwall thing or anything like that. But I grew up in Battersea, and you walked to school with CFC NF on the wall in 1981. it didn't feel like the club for me, you know. So I only mentioned that because it's incrementally these attitudes change by providing these kind of positive images. And, you know, when the day comes, if the day comes, hopefully the day comes in the Premier League where you have your gay footballer and it doesn't matter. We have lots of gay footballers and nobody will leave. Anyone even become news in the same way that in society it's become not news to a degree anyway. So you want that kind of incremental change. And that's the quote unquote good that football can do if anything, because it is so much in the spotlight. And maybe this is the start of it maybe this is the start of it again. Mm. We've had many false starts. Maybe this is the start of it again for this generation in this digital era where the message gets spread further.
There is a responsibility, is there not? If we talk about the role that football can play and hopefully as a positive way to make change or to change people's minds about certain things, but there is a responsibility with the people who talk about the game and who cover the game and who follow the game and who write about the game and the media and the way that they cover it. So, for example, in this day and age, you know, sometimes it's hard to get your head around the fact that there's this, well, we should hear both sides. We need to hear both sides of the story. Well, hang on a second. I didn't think that in 2018 we would need to hear the other side when the other side is white supremacy, right? I just could not have envisaged that 20 years ago, you know, not being blind to what goes on in the world, but just the idea that we should debate the other side. There is no other side of racism, you know? So it's about making sure that that message is put across, but it's got to be put across in a way that perhaps isn't preachy. You know, people don't respond particularly well to being told things they probably know deep down are true. It's a difficult thing to try and get your head around, but there has to be a level of education, Clive. Is that the right word in how we talk about these things?
And this is why this will not be resolved really, really quickly. And because it's going to take education. It's going to take more and more people being around more and more people who are educated. It's going to take more and more black people to be educated, to be around more and more white people, to make sure they see another perception of people. Mm. Right. So, and I think, again, you know, what is the perception of a black person? It varies, right? It varies based on your upbringing, your environment, and it varies on the messaging that you've been given. And that's why I think what Raheem did is he focused on the message and he made certain people that control the messaging look at themselves. Mm-hmm. And that for me is, I think that's been unique. I don't know if I've missed it in the past, but not to this level, because now, you know, Raheem Sterling has got a big following. Right, he has got a big following of people, so his message can reach a lot of people. We know that newspapers are struggling per se with the written word, and getting their word out there. So they're looking for an online group. So, but Raheem Sterling's got a big online group, right? LeBron James has got a big online group, and so now there's a platform for them to get this message across. And this is why I think it has been unique this time, because now we're seeing people look at themselves. And I wonder, will it change? It's going to take years of education, but the almost the quickest way to Rome is to look at the messaging that's coming from those media outlets. It's not all of their fault, but they have a platform to reach many, many people and start to be careful about the words they use for not just black people, but for different minority groups, including women and LGBT people. And this is something that's going to hopefully trigger a turn in the page. But I do worry. I can almost hear Tayo saying, Clive, you're too positive, mate. and then when Liverpool Man United comes on and Sky on Sunday, I wonder what I'll be thinking about.
I do know what you mean, and I think you're right to be positive. And I'm, you know, maybe I'm being slightly more nihilistic, but you know, I just want, you know, Jose Mourinho is a wanker. He's not a Portuguese wanker. He's just a wanker.
Yeah.
You know, and that's so clear to me. His wankiness is not part of his Iberian nature or anything like that. It's because of, you know, a playground, you know, the playground attitude that I've got towards football. Yeah. I don't understand. And that is why I also think that the messaging, the people doing the messaging are very intelligent people, you know, are very intelligent people a lot of the time. The journalists and broadcasters and so forth. And you've seen that in many of the reactions. That's why I think my most depressing thing, and I wish I had a better filter than you, as you, Clive. And that is why I'm disappointed about the, some people are staying silent on it. Some people are deliberately sending people in the wrong direction And I find that more dangerous because that just hardens people's views. So the reason why I'm slightly kind of more nihilistic than you probably is because I've seen this movie before. You've seen this movie before.
Uh-huh.
And so you end up kind of, you know, hopefully someone will hear this and think, well, maybe someone somewhere's got a point. Next time I'll think about what I say. I've certainly changed my language on many subjects over the years. When somebody told me it was, when somebody tells me it's offensive, then you've got to listen, because it would be easy to turn around and say, well, that's just how it is, and you all could be offended by anything these days. You know, which is another classic of the genre. But you know what? Just sometimes, just stop and listen to what someone's saying. Maybe the girl at work doesn't want to be called love again. You don't mean anything by me. If she doesn't, then just don't call her. If she says that, don't turn around to her and say, "What's wrong with you, love? You should get used to it." I've always said that. I'm not sexist. I don't. Do you know what I mean? Let's just listen, and you know, football's a platform to do that. And you're right that what Raheem Sterling has done with that messaging is make somebody somewhere have that conversation and think twice next time they're going to write something, next time they're going to write some garbage clickbait article about him buying a sink, you know what I mean, or whatever. But then also maybe that will change something, like you said early on in the piece, Clive, and what John Barnes has said, is that maybe that will change a certain attitude to the person next door, not just the person on the TV, the person next door, because this is an everyday thing.
I mean, listen to John Barnes. Just think for a moment, right? That guy had one job in management and he's no longer working in the game of football. Just imagine what a guy of that intelligence could do in the game of football today. Right? And I find it criminal the way he was treated when he went into management. And regardless of what people felt of his abilities on that occasion, he was never given a chance to learn by his experience and to be still in the game. And to hear him talk, I think we do ourselves a disservice by keeping people outside of the game on that. And you imagine what he could do. If you think there's one third of the players in the Premiership are black, I believe. And if you look at all the England under-17s, under-18s, under-19s, under-20s, under-21s, look at those team pictures. Look at the Arsenal Academy pictures. Just take a look at them and see what's coming around the corner. And we've got people like John Barnes on Breakfast TV. He should be doing something else than that. He really should be because
Sorry to cut across you, by the way. You just got me. That's the good thing, though, Clive, that you say you look at the Arsenal youth team, you look at the England team like that. That's the kind of incremental change that is. I mean, if someone told you that on the terraces in 1977,
I wouldn't believe it.
you would have you would have been amazed to see that. And you've been through, like, I wish I'd spoken to you earlier. The changes that you see, by the time I've kind of turned up in the game, there are black people in the stands next to me and no one's spitting or down my back. Do you know what I mean? So to go and do that, maybe that incremental change will speed up, because like most things do in a kind of digital era. And maybe we will see more black managers and black coaches, because that's the final frontier, or the next frontier anyway.
It is. And I do a little bit of coaching myself, and when I go around non-league grounds, I can see the changes at a lower level. And then you look at what Sol Campbell's doing right now, and I fear he's been set up for a fall. Maybe that's a cynic in me. But I want him to succeed just because of the people that are going to follow behind him, right? And the cameras are on him at the moment, and I think he has to succeed, because I don't think he's going to get two or three chances to fail. And that's the environment that I'd like to see change, where people can succeed, fail, get equal opportunities. That's all. And the messaging reduces those opportunities for me. And that's the key message that I've taken from the last week.
Gentlemen, look, I've been sitting here in silence listening to both of you. And it goes back to what Tayo said a few minutes ago, just about listening. It's been educational for me. Even from, a position that I would consider relatively enlightened, but it's been a pleasure to have you both on the show. If there's anything else you'd just like to make a final point on, please feel free.
I mean, I've got one thing that you just raised there, actually. You said enlightened as well. Imagine now, look how woke has been turned into a kind of sneering pejorative of somebody who actually does want to listen.
Mm.
Oh, you're getting all woke. I mean, what... what the fuck is that? Sorry. So to listen, to question something is quote unquote virtue signaling or trying to be woke? Nah, son, that's not right. That's the only thing I wanted to add, because he just made me think of it there. That's another thing that hardens the views of people who don't want to listen.
It's
pernicious.
Absolutely, it is. It's that thing where you are immediately labeled one thing or another thing. It goes back to the fucking Wenger out or AKB thing, which was just absolute absurd nonsense, unthinking, unintelligent bullshit. The minute you label somebody as one thing or another thing, you find no middle ground whatsoever, because you're on your perch over here and the other guy's on his perch over there, and in between you is just a fucking moat of sharks and horror, you know? So you've got to be able to listen and be open to ideas, even if it challenges what you think you know or what you've always known throughout your life. So, look, gents, it's been a fantastic discussion. Clive, thanks very much indeed. Really appreciate the time.
Pleasure, mate. Thanks for asking me on.
Tayo, as always, a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for doing this as well. I really appreciate it.
Not an easy discussion, but a necessary discussion, I think. And I was glad to have it with Tayo, who you can follow on Twitter, at DJ Tayo. And Clive Palmer, who is at Clive PAFC, and Clive is also a regular on the Arsenal Vision podcast, which I know many of you listen to as well.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Right, if you're looking for an Arsenal book for Christmas, you could do a lot worse than the new publication from my next guest on the podcast. Along with Mark Andrews and Andy Kelly, Josh James is the author of Arsenal, The Complete Record. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Not at all. This is quite the publication. Basically, in very short terms, it's every game, every season, every player, every manager from Arsenal's history, plus a lot of other stats and information in there too. And as someone who's put together a few books in my time, I'm looking at this in kind of awe, but also terror. How long did this take to put together?
Well, a lifetime, really. Pretty much from when I started working at Arsenal, I've been collating stats and just growing and growing. And the same for the other two guys, especially Andy, who has got a huge database of players and games and lineups. So it's something that has sort of grown literally over years and years. And then when we decided to put it together as a book. That was about a year ago now, probably just over. So actually to collate it in book form took about a year, I'd say.
Right. And in terms of the information that's in there, you know, we're talking about official lineups of games going back into the 1800s, the early 1900s. That kind of information isn't always, A, easy to find, and B, verify. Was that a challenge that you had to come across? Obviously, you say Andy had a big database himself and stuff that he put together, but trying to make sure that the information is accurate must have been a bit of a challenge as well.
Yeah, so with Andy and Mark, the co-authors, they specialise in researching and digging out all sorts of source material from, you know, 19th century Arsenal and back to the very foundation. And that's what they've been doing for years and years. It was a hobby, and now they've written several books about it. So they're the guys really that dig into the history side of it from, you know, pre-moving to North London in from foundation in 1886 onwards. So they're the guys really that spend their time in, spend their lives really in the newspaper libraries and going through as much as they can find. And they never stop. They keep looking for verifiable second sources and to find all these stories. And they've unearthed hundreds of these great stories from more than 100 years ago. So that's really their speciality. And where I came in, I've been working at the club now for 17 years. So I've been across collating the stats, editing the handbook every year. And just year on year, you refine your stats and you refine your history, and you get to a place where you're pretty comfortable with how reliable it is. But as I say, it's never ending. You go on and you hope to find more stuff and unearth more
players'
names and so on. So it's an ongoing job, really.
I remember we did a live podcast last year and somebody came along and had a scrapbook that I guess their grandfather had kept from the 1930s, cutouts and bits and pieces that he put in from the newspapers at that time, and it was a treasure trove of information that had been sitting in an attic somewhere. So all these things can be, you know, discovered in time and, you know, can add to the archives, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. That's you know, first-hand material, because football clubs have produced literature, match day programs and handbooks for years and years, and it's just a case of getting your hands on them and knowing what to believe and what not to believe, and steering clear of Wikipedia and stuff like that, because it's the primary source material, which is really valuable, and obviously the club holds a lot of that. But over the years, stuff gets lost and then reappears, and it's historians such as Andy and Mark who can really know where to look for it.
Sure. What kind of archives or what kind of attention did the club pay over the years to the history and to preserving information and archiving historical information? Was that a thing, or was it something that, you know, wasn't paid a great deal of attention to until such point as somebody said, hey, this is important, we've got to keep a treasure trove of information here for you know, for the future, or for not just for your benefit when you're putting something like this together, but do the club maintain a kind of archive of historical information as well?
Well, yes and no. It's sort of depending on whoever was at the club at the time and how important they felt it to be. So we've had historians throughout the years, and there's a guy called Ian Cook who's been around the club for years, and he's a historian who collates and gathers artifacts and whatever he can get his hands on, really, through auctions and wherever they are. But in a formal collection or an archive or a library, it hasn't really existed, because it's not something that you know, it's not a priority at the club, is it? It's a nice to have, and it's almost your casual hobbyists who collect this stuff and who have an interest in it who are really valuable for that side of it. We have like these big, huge, dusty books that are somewhere in the Highbury House storage called Ledgers, where all the lineups are written down. But obviously in the last 20 years or so, a lot of it's gone digital and it's all online. So that sort of side of it has died out. There's no single collection. It's what I'm trying to say. I suppose it's all bits and pieces everywhere, which I guess is half the fun as well. You don't know what you're going to unearth.
Yeah, fair enough. And in the process of making this book, and Mark and Andy wrote another book recently along with Tim Stillman called Royal Arsenal, which we covered on the show as well. Are they always finding new angles to stories or things that we thought were true in the past that aren't necessarily true or perhaps have been over the years exaggerated for effect. I'm thinking of the promotion in 1919 where, you know, if you listen to some people, the story is that, you know, it was all smoke and mirrors and surreptitious bribery and all kinds of stuff going on, but it doesn't appear to have been quite as nefarious as that.
No, when they dig into the history and the details, as you say, back in 1919 when Arsenal were not promoted, but I suppose elected into the top flight, into Division One as it was then, after finishing sixth the year before. And people are saying it's at the expense of Spurs, which is a great story, and it was at the expense of Spurs. But when you actually look at the quotes, and Spurs said they took the decision as sportsmen, there wasn't as much controversy at the time. And given the context of it, it wasn't a promotion, it was an election, and they decided to restructure the league, and teams were invited to apply for it, and Nottingham Forest were one of the teams who applied, and they finished 18th in Division 2, so they had less say to it than Arsenal. And there was lots of different factors behind the decision, and it is, when you read it in the context, that these sort of things make more sense. But yeah, they dig out lots of previously unknown stories, and one of them was going back to 1904 when Phil Kelso, the manager at the time, had taken over from Harry Bradshaw. Harry Bradshaw had resigned the year before. Harry Bradshaw was basically a 19th century or early 20th century Herbert Chapman, very successful, getting Arsenal developing each season. He resigned halfway through the season, said he'd stay on, and it was previously thought he'd stayed on until the end of the season, but he left just before Arsenal clinched promotion, which seems a bit odd now if you're thinking that Arsenal were in the running for a trophy and the manager decided to leave just before it was clinched. So that just goes to show the level of investigation that they go through to find out these stories and to verify them, and that was previously unearthed by anyone.
There are always things, I suppose, when you look into the history of a football club that will surprise you. Was there anything that you came across that you really had no idea about? I was looking through the back of the book where you have all the players that have ever played for the club, the nationalities of them. And I remember talking to a friend who told me about the fact that Arsenal had an Icelandic player in the 1940s. Albert Gudmundsson. And it was like, hang on a minute, that's a bit exotic, isn't it, for the 1940s? But lo and behold, it's true. He's in there. He's in the record. Is there anything else that you came across that you didn't previously know or was a surprise or a shock?
Well, there's plenty. that was the pleasure of proofing it, which I did several times in the end. But to go through and read these stories, and I think it's mainly the personalities and the players. As you say, there's someone you read about and you think, well, how did he end up playing football at Arsenal? And then there's a great story behind lots of these guys. There was a striker called Tim Coleman, or his name was John Coleman, but anyone he didn't know the name of or had forgotten the name of, he called Tim, and that was just how he became referred to. He then became called Tim Coleman himself. There was a guy called Joe Murphy, always played in a flat cap or a wig, so he became known as the Judge, Joe Murphy. And there's loads of these profiles of players throughout the book. And they're just great characters who just seems a world away from what we see today. Obviously, the professional football and these world famous players, where these were just regular guys who each had their own story as well.
I like the idea of a footballer playing in a flat cap or a wig. I could sort of imagine Aubameyang perhaps getting on board with that kind of thing.
Puma can bring out a range of flat caps, and I'm sure we'll be all for
Adidas,
it.
Adidas. Next year, of course. One of the things that's always fascinated me about football on a very basic level is statistics, and I know that's something you're really interested in, but I'm sure when you were a kid as well, you had that little handbook that you got. It could have been the Rothmans football handbook. Yep. Where it listed every game or every club, and it gave basic statistics for each, like the highest attendance, the biggest win, the biggest defeat. Am I right in remembering this, that Arsenal's biggest win and biggest defeat were against Loughborough?
Loughborough Town, yeah. Yes. But yeah. And again, there's stories behind those games, because it was The day of the record defeat, we actually had to play two games, to honour two fixtures in the same day, and so we sent a reserve team to play one of the games. So there are stories behind those records as well, and the records and the stats are endless. And I know it's not for everyone, and you're bordering in real nerdish territory a lot of the time. So what we've decided to do is to break it up, and you have a history book and a stats book in one, and it sort of interweaves throughout it. But yeah, if you're into the statistics and the lineups and the records and the lists, there's plenty there, and you can sort of get lost in it all. And it is quite amazing the level of detail that you can go to. Because nowadays we have all the Opta stats and everything's measured, but even back in the day, to have the lineups for every single game that the club has played, it is quite impressive when you see it all laid out in one go, because it's just so striking how many games, every game that we live through at the moment, it seems like it's life and death, isn't it? And it's a massive occasion. And it's, when you realise they've been doing this for more than 100 years, it's quite awe-inspiring, really.
Yeah, it will continue after we're gone. I think
absolutely.
One of the things that's striking when you look through the book and you go, you pick a random season. I'm at 1924-25 here, where the manager was Leslie Knighton and the captain was Alf Baker. And I'm looking through all the lineups here, and it's essentially the same guys in every game. Throughout the entire season. And, we can talk as much as we like about how football these days is more physically demanding. Players have got to be, they've got to run more, they've got to sprint more. But back then, they still had to run. They had to run on boggy pitches. They had to contend with opponents who would be quite happy to tackle them at knee height or above. And they had to do it without, let's say, the facilities that the players these days have in terms of training, in terms of rehab, in terms of physio, in terms of medical. There was no such thing as high performance or conditioning or anything like that. It was like, get yourself out on the pitch. Here's an orange and maybe an injection.
Yeah.
It's amazing to see it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a different, it's almost a different sport, isn't it? It's so far removed. And there's a great story in one of the seasons. I think it's 1906, early 20th century, and Arsenal played Man City in a league game. And the game was so hot, it was 52 degrees in the sun, that five City players couldn't finish the game. They had six players on the pitch, and Arsenal took pity on them and only won 4-1 in the end. But there's lots of stories like that when you think, well, that just simply wouldn't happen nowadays, and games played in all sorts of conditions. Mm. Referees getting punched by fans coming on the pitch. So it's a throwback, but it just seems, when you go season by season, it's a gradual change. You don't notice it, but when you look back 100 years in one chunk, you think, how on earth is this the same sport, same club, same team? It's the gradual change. You don't notice it, but when you look back, it's obviously a completely different world they were playing in.
Sure is. As somebody who worked or has worked at the club for, I don't know how many years now,
17 years.
17
now.
Years. So throughout most of the Arsene Wenger era, your knowledge of that particular era and his reign as manager is undoubtedly second to none in terms of statistics and everything else. But how does Wenger's reign match up in terms of other managers from the past, the successful ones and maybe not so successful?
Well, it's just the sheer duration, which is the most striking thing. We've got a list of all the managers at the back of the book and their overall records, and he just dwarfs them all in terms of games played, games won, players used, trophies, just you name it, he's at the top of it. And it's an outlier, you could say. It's sort of distortingly bigger than everyone else, and that's... So the book comes out up to the end of last season, which is obviously the end of Arsene Wenger's reign. And when you put it into context, because we've all lived through that time, and we knew the Invincible season was a remarkable season and a one-off and a historic season and winning all the FA Cups. But when you see it in comparison to the rest of the club, which let's not forget has been successful more often than not throughout history and has had several successful periods, when you see it compared to all the other managers in the other periods, it's incredible, really, the longevity of it. Seeing it in the raw numbers tells you that. Obviously, everyone, all the fans who's lived through it will know their own memories and have their own opinions of the time, but when you see the numbers, it rams it home, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, a hugely successful era, frustrating era in many ways as well in the second half of it. But
absolutely, yeah. And you build your own expectations, and when Bertie Mee won the double for Arsenal in 71, and was, you know, this was the most successful season Arsenal had ever had, and within 3 or 4 years they're struggling against relegation, and that's how you know things go from good to bad all the time, and it could be under the same manager, but when you think Arsenal were being called to be struggling when they were finishing fifth or sixth, yet you know Bertie Mee was holding on to his job when Arsenal finishing in the bottom half. So it's all relative, and obviously expectations change. And looking at the Arsene Wenger period as a whole, it's just a hugely successful 22 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. You set standards and people come to expect you to live up to those standards. Consistency in football, as everybody knows, is the most difficult thing, I guess. The book is full of amazing little stats and asides in every season. For example, going back to 2003-2004, the 9-8 win penalty shootout win over Rotherham in the League Cup is the only shootout ever staged at Highbury, which is an amazing thing for a stadium that was home to Arsenal for so many years.
Yeah, and we've not had one at Emirates yet, so it's the only home penalty shootout we've ever had.
Does seem
to be a bit of an anomaly. But
do you know if that is an anomaly? Your knowledge of other clubs and their stats is probably.
I don't care about them, to be honest.
Okay.
I don't know. Penalty shootouts. When was the first one we had? Was probably the Cup Winners' Cup final. So it's only really. In the past 20, 30 years that they've been around. But it does seem very strange. I mean, we could have one. There's no extra time now, in the Carabao Cup, so maybe we could have one on Wednesday night.
Well, maybe so. Now that we've talked about it, it's definitely going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, listen, best of luck with the book. It's absolutely fantastic. It's called Arsenal, The Complete Record, and it is absolutely the complete record of the history and the statistical history of Arsenal Football Club. But loads of great stuff in there as well. Joshua, all the best with it, and thanks very much.
No, thanks for having me. Thanks.
The book is Arsenal, The Complete Record. It's published by De Coubertin. I don't know how you pronounce that. I should have figured that out. But anyway, that's who publishes it. But go to your local independent bookstore and say you would like a copy of Arsenal, The Complete Record by Josh James, Andy Kelly, and Mark Andrews. It is an amazing book. There's so much in here and so many little snippets and things that you thought you knew but you didn't know. And just even looking over the stats, even if you're not a particularly stats-friendly person, it's fantastic. There's just so much in here I can't even begin to tell you. So if you're looking for a book for yourself this Christmas or for the Arsenal fan in your life, you could do a lot worse than check out Arsenal, The Complete Record. So look, that's just about it for this particular show. Thank you for being here as always. We've got a game against Southampton on Sunday. It's hard to preview because it's only hours since we played Carabag. Obviously, there'll be some heavy rotation, and we'll wait and see what kind of team selection Unai Emery gets together, particularly when it comes to the centre of his defence. If you are looking for more Arsenal stuff to consume, remember, we've got loads of it on our Patreon site. If you become an Arseblog member on Patreon, you get instant access to a ton of podcasts, including a brand new Pastcast Extra, in which James and I podcast the 3-2 win over Chelsea at Stamford Bridge in 1999, the Kanu hat-trick, as if it had just happened. That follows up on some of the other ones, but there's loads of other history podcasts in there, episodes of My Arse, there's a recent one with Dara O'Brien, there's loads of articles, long reads. It costs just a fiver a month, plus VAT, if you're in the EU. If you're not in the EU, you don't have to pay VAT. That's all it is, and you get instant access to all that content. To sign up and to help support everything that we do here on Arseblog, Arseblog News, and the free podcast that we do, check it out. It's patreon.com/Arseblog. patreon.com/Arseblog. James and I will be here with an Arsecast Extra on Monday. We'll be looking back at the Southampton game and ahead to the Carabao Cup semi-final, quarter-final rather, against Tottenham. Until then, take it easy. Have yourselves a great weekend. Catch you on the next one. Cheers. Bye-bye.
This Christmas, give the gift of a lifetime to the Spurs fan in your life. Full, unedited footage of the incredible 1-1 win over Barcelona in the Champions League. The comeback of all comebacks. Result of all results. Out now on DVD, Blu-ray and Betamax. Plus, the director's cut with exclusive audio commentary from Eric Dyer.
1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 2.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.